now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. First of all, happy birthday, America. Today is July 4th in America, Independence Day, and we should always honor and remember and cherish that holiday, no matter where in the world you live. If you live anywhere and you cherish and you value freedom, then I encourage you, if you're really not aware of all the major points, the salient points about America's War of Independence, it's never too late to get your nose in the books and do a bit of reading, because it's going to be time well spent. The founding fathers of America had a couple of things in common. They were absolutely brilliant, generally speaking. You would be hard-pressed to find in any era such a collection of absolutely brilliant minds, people steeped in libertarian constitutional values. Indeed, they're the ones that created the Constitution. But also the bravery of these individuals, the strength of character, the integrity. Always remember, only a tiny fraction of the colonists rebelled against the crown. Something like 3% of the people rebelled. The rest were content to stay on their farms, stay in the taverns. But that 3% changed the course of history. And I'll tell you right now, there's no way they would have put up with the level of tyranny that we're experiencing here, seeing on a daily, nay, moment-to-moment, minute-to-minute basis. Because one of the issues I'm going to address today is the siege mentality. They being the oppressive ruling sewer scum, want-to-be ruling sewer scum class, they have effectively placed everyone on this planet into a siege state, a siege mentality, siege status. And those people who are aware of what's going on, at least the surface level aspects of it, I can feel your pain, I can feel your emotional distress, the endless slings and arrows of more fear-mongering, more hype, more racial divide, more race-baiting, more communist indoctrination, more Luciferian crap, over and over and over, incessant, and a veritable avalanche of it. And even if you make a point of tuning out all that rubbish, mind-destroying, corrosive rubbish from the lamestream media, it's virtually impossible to get away from the memes and the narrative, because you're just virtually surrounded by these bovine... I used to say that these people were slaves, the masses of humanity, especially in the Western world, but that's not quite accurate, because slaves know they're slaves. And you really can't even call them... Well, yes, they are domesticated. They are a form of livestock, but the quadruped variety of livestock on our planet, they know they're livestock for the most part, right? They know that they lead pitiable, miserable existences and that they're a food source. This latest iteration of what passes for humanity, humanity 4.0, 5.0, 9.0, who knows how many, in the briefing papers Bob Lazar read in his time at S4, if memory serves, there was something in there about at least the Greys, the Zeta Reticuleans, being one of the genetic engineering groups, had genetically altered or corrected the human race something on the order of 28 times by that point, okay? So, 28 different times in the evolution of the human race, there was these corrections, these genetic alterations. And that's just one race, that's just the Zetas. But who are the Zetas really working for? I would argue that at least some of the Gray factions work for the Reptilians. They work for the Draco, they work for the Orion Empire, essentially. So this latest version of humanity, it is a domesticated livestock race. It's not just a slave race, as some who follow the works of Sitchin and others, the Anunnaki Chronicles, for lack of a better term, would have you believe that, oh, this is just like a slave race and they've been created to do the mining. Yes, they've been created to do the mining and much more. But they're essentially a livestock race. They're essentially just meant to be part of a big end times type harvest. So I'm no longer calling them slaves, because I've never known in since recorded history of slaves who didn't know they were slaves, right? And Frederick Douglass, the late great black abolitionist, said, and I'm paraphrasing here, and you've heard me say this before, that a slave is first shackled in his mind before he's shackled in his body. And that's exactly what we see today. These slaves mooing along, wearing their mask and utter abject terror due to all this fear-mongering. And getting back to the Founding Fathers, there were the 3%. The other 97%, I wouldn't say the other 97% at that time were mindless automatons like we have today, but I would say that they decided to keep their head down because they felt they had more to lose, or if the crown did impose a total tyranny, and you have to understand by that point, one of the key points behind the rebellion, one of many, the taxation was just a small part of it, and typical of the controlled publishing, controlled academia, that they would harp and endlessly harp about the taxation, right, without representation. It was the fact that a central bank was foisted, or was attempted to be foisted on the colonists, and also the quartering of troops. Colonists were expected to allow British troops or British mercenaries, Hessians, for example, to be quartered, to live in their homes, no questions asked. And a lot of people said, no, that's not on. I'm not going to let these friggin' smelly foreigners come in here and just, you know, put their feet up and just lounge around my house and order us around and, right, abuse our families. Ain't going to happen. So they rebelled, 3%. And I'm telling you, the Founding Fathers would never have put up with this amount of abuse. They would just become irate, livid, at any suggestion of taking away their freedoms. And we've seen gradually, incrementally over time, and now it's progressing by leaps and bounds, this effort at, well, the enslavement of humanity for all intents and purposes. That's already in the can. Now we're seeing the harvesting, the slaughter of the livestock being run off the cliff. So let's look back on the 4th of July, Independence Day, a holiday they're trying to eradicate in America. And just remember what those colonists fought for. Then you look at the American Civil War, the war between the states, the war of northern aggression, right? Two of the key battles, Vicksburg and Gettysburg, Vicksburg, Mississippi, far more important than Pennsylvania's Gettysburg, and the campaigns happened simultaneously. But Gettysburg to this day still gets most of the attention, most of the publicity. But Vicksburg, and you've heard me talk about this before, it was a far more, from overall strategic standpoint, far more critical campaign. And it was a brilliant campaign by General Ulysses S. Grant. And the Confederate forces were besieged in Vicksburg, which is right on the banks of the Mississippi River. And in a brilliant campaign, Grant, leading up to the battles within Vicksburg itself, in the siege of Vicksburg, Grant outmaneuvered his opponent and essentially surrounded Vicksburg and besieged Vicksburg. And it was a siege that lasted for a couple of months. The campaign began around, you know, depending on who you talk to and what key moment in the campaign, generally from May to July 3rd, was the length of the Vicksburg campaign. The Confederates were cut off from reinforcement. They were having to deal with bombardment from the Federal Navy, artillery barrages from the Federal forces under Grant's command. And eventually, the commander of the Vicksburg garrison, General John Pemberton, who was originally a Union man, a Federal man, coming from Philadelphia, he had married a woman from Virginia, and it gives you an example, yet again, of the divided loyalties, how that war created schisms right in families, where sons were battling fathers, and brothers were battling brothers, and cousins were battling cousins, and in-laws were battling in-laws, and kind of what we see now in a different way. And General John Pemberton, commander of the Confederate garrison at Vicksburg, surrendered on July 4th, 1863. That opened up the whole of the Mississippi River from the Gulf of Mexico all the way up north and essentially bifurcated, divided the Confederacy. And in overall strategic terms, it was far more important, especially since over in the east at Gettysburg, General George Gordon Meade did not follow up his defensive victory at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. He should have run Lee's army down into the ground after Gettysburg, but he let, like so many before him, had let Lee slip back into Virginia. So Vicksburg, Pennsylvania, Mississippi, rather, was the key battle of July 1863, and it was a siege. And how do we characterize a siege? A siege is when one force surrounds another force, one military force surrounds another military force in a given location. The city of Vicksburg, for example, in Caesar's Gallic Wars, the siege at Alesia, Vercingetorix, or Vercingetorix, however you pronounce his name, was the leader of a confederation of Gallic tribes that rebelled against Julius Caesar. And Caesar had surrounded the forces of Vercingetorix, prevented any reinforcement, and gradually began the process of starving out the Gallic tribes. And that is a characteristic of a siege, where you're surrounded, the besieging force, the outward force trying to take a citadel, trying to take a city, trying to take a fort. They make it so resupply is virtually impossible. The people within the garrison, within the besieged location, have no access to the outside world, no reinforcement, no means to replenish, reprovision. They're essentially cut off from the world. And that creates its own unique stresses, right? And there have been a number of sieges throughout history, some of them quite long. Some of the sieges lasted weeks, months. The Siege of Malta by the Ottoman Turks, 1565. The siege, well, in modern times, Malta again in World War II. It was being bombed constantly by the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. The people were under siege. And a siege mentality takes root, and that's what I see happening today. Because the real information, the information we know, which contradicts all the nonsense that's being spewed out, is being suppressed. We're just peppered, pelted with constant lies from the lying media. That is reinforced by the bovine mutterings of the livestock class around us, who just endlessly repeat what they've heard and what they've seen, because they've been lodged, enmeshed into their R complex, where they're in fear for their miserable, pathetic lives, and they would presume to hold their lives and have more value for their lives than for us, right? And so they would have no qualms about taking away all of our rights just to assuage their fears, just to make them feel better, just so they can comfortably curl up into a fetal position and suck their pacifier or their thumb at night They want to take away everyone else's rights and in the process kill them off because they're too stupid to realize how dangerous these treatments are. So a siege mentality has set in. On the one hand, for the people that are switched on, at least at a surface level, they know about the depopulation, they know about the spike proteins, they know about now the graphene, in the treatments, let's say. And my colleagues and I have been talking about this from the start, the transceiver nature of the nanotech, the sending and receiving, and when they get excited by external frequency waves, that they can engender all kinds of effects, responses, behavioral responses, physiological changes and illnesses within people that have received the treatments, let's say, whether it was through the testing, by getting something shoved up their nose, or by getting the jab, right? It's a state of siege where the bovine classes, they just feel they're under siege because they can't stop watching the TV. It's an addiction for them. And then the people that have an idea, at least at a surface level, what's going on, they see it as a siege too. Or they may not consciously think of it as a siege, but they're starting to develop that feeling of what it's like to be a cornered animal, what it's like to be hunted, what it's like to be behind the eight ball. And now with all these strident demands for mandatory treatments all across the board, that feeling of that siege mentality of being surrounded, of being cut off, it is accentuated. And the slings and arrows are coming in fast and furious. The media just relentlessly demonizing the so-called unvaxxed. It's the unvaxxed that are responsible for the Delta variant. It's the unvaxxed that are responsible for the spread of this contagion. It's the unvaxxed this, it's the unvaxxed that. Every time you pass by a TV news station, it's vaccination, unvaxxed, unvaxxed, vaccination, mass vaccinations, 80%. It's just relentless, and it underscores again just how evil the would-be rulers of this planet are, where they can just lie through their teeth, through their media, to compel people, to browbeat people into willingly taking on toxins that will potentially kill them, or at the very least shorten their lives. And it adds to that hunted feeling, that cornered feeling, that behind the eight ball feeling. And again, I think of all these sieges throughout history, the Siege of Leningrad. Some of the people had to resort to cannibalism in order to survive the harsh winters there in northern Russia, northern USSR at the time. It's a siege mentality, and it's difficult at times to not have a feeling of being prey, of being hunted, of being hounded, of being backed into a corner, painted into a corner. And that's exactly the mentality they want us to be in. Instead of federal cannonballs, you know, flying in, and federal shells flying into Vicksburg or Atlanta, I'm not picking a particular side in the American Civil War, the war between the states, etc., etc. I'm just using the example of a siege, right? In this instance, it's not artillery shells, or in the case of the Siege of Alesia, in Caesar's campaigns, catapults, the scorpion, so-called, to shoot this bolt, this pointed, barbed, heavy bolt, quite a distance with quite a lot of accuracy. And it's not just like one or two of these scorpions. We're like dozens of them just being blasted away, is being fired at the Gaelic tribesmen earthworks, right? And they were quite accurate. Instead of being pelted and assailed that way, we're assailed by crass stupidity, we're assailed by the bovine acceptance of people. Every time I go out and I see these people all masked up, they just got this hangdog expression on their face, this bovine acceptance. That's part of the psyop too. Because, remember, the Founding Fathers, there were just 3% of them. And those 3% change history for the next 200 plus years. And then when I go out and I just see all these cattle, all these domesticated animals in the guise of humans, it's hard for me as a person by my nature, as a spiritual warrior, and within my breast is ignited and will always remain ignited the lambent flame of freedom and liberty. Call me judgmental, sticks and stones, etc., but I can't help but looking at a lot of these people with a certain degree of disgust. I can't help it, because they are a force multiplier for this system. So, in the case of Alesia, when Caesar's forces had besieged the forces of Vercingetorix, his forces, and we're talking entire tribes, a conglomeration of tribes that rebelled against Caesar, fighting for their freedom, basically. And Caesar was the first to say in his commentaries, they're fighting for their freedom. Well, yeah, definitely they were, right? Caesar's not going to mince any words. He's not going to play any games. Caesar was a conqueror, and the Gallic tribes were fighting for their freedom, and Caesar said that. Food became an issue, as food is starting to become an issue now. Okay, the siege mentality is heightened. What we're seeing with this attempted mass treatment program is just the latest in a series of siege tactics, right? The false flags, the never-ending attempts to take gun ownership away from Americans, the Coudenhove-Kalergi plan flooding Europe and flooding the UK and flooding America with these raping mob minorities, and they're trying to turn them into majorities, right? In the UK, you have the Paki grooming gangs, so-called. You have the Islamists of all stripes just attacking and raping children and just doing all these horrendous things, right? That's part of the siege. The incessant gaslighting from the media, that's a siege weapon. It may look different from a catapult. It may look different from a bolt, but it's still a part of the siege tradecraft. You have the incessant cancel culture, LGBTU, cultural Marxism, in your face constantly. That's part of the siege weaponry. And those of us in the know, who at least, at the very least, at a surface level, we see all this. Slings and arrows literally coming in from every direction. Yeah, at times this war weariness kicks in. Something somewhat akin to combat fatigue, even. This mental combat fatigue, right? At this point, we didn't have to undergo the physical combat, right? You know, think about those Marines in the Army in the Battle of Hue, just the, you know, the stupidity of their higher command sending them into Hue that was already in the possession of like 10,000 NVA regulars and hardcore mainline VC battalions and NVA battalions. And these people, those communists have been, some of them have been fighting for decades, right? Whereas the Marines that were just sent in there with no prior intelligence, and their leadership just with their blinders on, thinking that the North Vietnamese Army, what they call the People's Army of Vietnam, just was not capable of taking over a city the size of Hue, right? And it goes back to what Sun Tzu said, know who your enemy is, know your enemy. If you know who your enemy is and you know yourself, the outcome of 1,000 battles is assured, words to that effect, you can look it up, right? Know who it is you're fighting against. I mean, I do. We're up against the Draco Orion Empire and all their hybridized minions and the weaponized cattle here on the surface, right? Well, Sun Tzu had a lot to say about the ground, the field of battle, right? Know your ground. Know the terrain. Know the environment, the battle environment, right? And getting back to the Battle of Hue, Tet Offensive, these Marines were just set in there into a meat grinder, and their stupid idiot commander is just goading and hectoring the frontline commanders. Advance, 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 there's nothing there, and they got chopped up. They got chopped up big time. And then, when they got the Marines got some reinforcements, they had to go block by block, house by house, floor by floor, some of the worst city fighting American combat troops had ever undergone against a fanatical enemy. Brave, tactically savvy. Like I said, some of these communists have been fighting for years, fighting the French. If they weren't fighting the French, they were fighting the Chinese, they were fighting somebody. A lot of combat experience. And those battle-hardened Marines and also the U.S. Army troops that tried to cut off the main route of resupply for the NVA and the VC, but particularly the Marines, because they were in the city of Hawaii. This combat fatigue and this mental and physical exhaustion had set in day after day after day. No safe places. Could be blasted by rockets, blasted by mortars, blasted by snipers. And I just can't imagine the kind of mental anxiety that would induce. Now, I'm not comparing what we're going through to that, right? I wouldn't disrespect combat veterans who've had to put up with that. But I would say that from a mental duress standpoint, the constant pelting, when you hear the old term to be pelted or being pelted down by rain, it goes back to this term, peltast. In ancient times, these were slingers, and these slingers were trained from childhood, and they would fire like these lead weights, great distances. You get nailed with one of those suckers, you get nailed in your shin, fracture, compound fracture, you're out. Laying around in an ancient battlefield, there ain't no triage system there, pal. You're better off getting one of those lead weights right in the skull, take you right out. You get hit any other part of the body, you're going down. There were peltasts. They would pelt. They would be, along with the skirmishers, they would go ahead of the main force. And along with the archers who would fire their arrows, these peltasts would be, there would be dozens of them. Places like the Balearic Islands in the Mediterranean, who were frequently used as hired as mercenaries by this, that, or the other army. And they would just be raining down these lead weights, stones, whatever they could fire, and they were accurate. And they would come down like hail, right? Imagine having to go up against that. That's what I mean, being pelted. Just the crass stupidity is a form of siege warfare. Every time you go to the store and you see these bovine masked up cattle trying to police you, trying to boss you around because they're in fear for their pathetic, miserable lives, and they're placing their lives holding it in a higher state of value than yours, to the point where they want you to do what they do, and so you can die too, a miserable, pitiable death. That mentality, it contributes to the siege mentality. There's almost no relief. Because even if you, like I said, even if you made a point of avoiding the news, you're going to come across all this cattle that will endlessly repeat the news, endlessly repeat the fear-mongering and the hype. All these variants popping up now. It's all fake. It's all bogus. As you know, they weren't even able to isolate the original problem, let alone, and then everything is an inversion. When something mutates, it's weaker than the original strain. But now these mutations are more powerful than the non-existent original strain. Knowing this, knowing that all that is a justification and a distraction and a psyop, it can add to this siege mentality. Getting back to Alesia, before I forget, because, you know, the whole thing about food, and now, because they're hyping up the climate change thing, and they're using the weather weaponry to increase the temperatures. Not too long ago, it was Texas. Now it's Pacific Northwest and the western part of Canada. They're just burning those people up with ridiculously high temperatures. I mean, 121, 122 degrees in places in Canada. I experienced that in Bullhead City. I experienced that in Las Vegas. I experienced that in Laughlin, Nevada, right? Bullhead City, Arizona. But You just don't expect that in Canada, right? But right on cue, Project Veritas had gotten that one guy on video saying that, oh yeah, we're hyping up the scamdemic, and we did everything we could to destroy Trump's presidency and yada yada yada. Next, we're going to hit him with the climate change. He said that. We're going to hit him with the climate change again, right? Right on cue. Again, this adds to the whole siege, the feeling of being besieged, right? There's people in Pacific Northwest and people in Canada, they're being hammered by heat waves. And probably some directed energy manipulation as well. So you have the endless immigration of increasingly in the U.S., especially now recently, with the open borders, and they're just pouring in. You have the Coudenhove-Kalergi plan, Europe at large. I mean, France, Italy, lots of areas in the U.K., completely unrecognizable now. The existing native majority is been reduced to a cowering minority, right? Because of the Frankfurt School type of just us system of justice there. They'll never get a fair shake. And these types were brought in specifically to run amok, okay? They cause all these problems. That's part of the siege mentality. That's part of being besieged. So now they're using climate change, weather weaponry, directed energy weapons, increased horrific heat, food shortages, drought conditions, the distribution networks, distribution chains, the food distribution system, the food growing system is all tanking. That's going to lead to widespread starvation. And at Elysia, the chieftains got together and they said, look, we're starving. We're running out of food. We have to feed the warriors, right? Because they knew they were painted into a corner, folks. That's what I mean. They knew there was no going back, okay? Because if they were lucky or unlucky, and they somehow survived the siege of Caesar's forces, the best thing they could hope for is to be sold back into a life of slavery, right? And that's why they were rebelling in the first place. A lot of them weren't slaves, but they've seen how their fellow tribesmen and women and children were taken away as slaves. Right? So they were rebelling against that. There was no going back for them. So the chieftains got together and said, let's offer up the women and children to Caesar's forces. Because even if they're taken into slavery, at least they'll survive, right? And we won't have to share our meager, fast dwindling resources, provisions, food with them. Key point. See, there were two lines of defense. There was the initial line of entrenchments, and the Romans were the great engineers of ancient times. They built these fortifications surrounding the Gallic tribes in this hilltop, which known as Elysia. And that hemmed in the garrison, that hemmed in all the tribesmen. They created a larger ring outside of that, facing outwards, to prevent any reinforcement from coming, okay? And the tribesmen just sat there and watched, day after day, week after week, these Roman legionaries, every single one of them, a trained engineer, just build these fortifications all around them, watchtowers, the whole bit. Trenches, spikes, everything. Food was growing short. Okay, let's offer up the women and children to Caesar. They just said, no, we're not accepting your women and children. And the tribesmen had the heartache of having to watch their loved ones starve to death. Because that's how it was back then. Still is, actually. Caesar said, not my problem. I'm not going to take them on. More mouths to feed. You keep them. And the chieftains had already decided we're not going to feed them because we have to feed the warriors. So again, like I said, they watched as the poor women and children, their own families, perish, die of malnutrition, starve right in front of them. The Romans looking down from their watchtowers, just observing, right? Point of relevance is, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures. That's what the Gallic chieftains had decided, and Vercingetorix, the commander of the Confederation of Tribes, said, yeah, that's pretty harsh, but that's what we'll have to do. And you know, the way that the distribution networks, the prices are going up because of the fiat currency is being so devalued by the incessant printing of fiat currency. It's all digital. Nothing's really being printed. It's just going to cause widespread food shortages. And this is going to lead to more crime, more dissolution, more chaos in the cities. And that adds to the stress levels, and that's part of the siege. So, how does one overcome this? Well, first, I would remind you, the listeners, dear listeners, that if you've followed this kind of information, if you've done your own kind of research, if you have more than a surface level understanding, you know that you've been through something like this before. Maybe not something this extreme, where the potential exists for your consciousness / soul, call it what you will, could be essentially trapped, held in some kind of limbo, potentially forever, okay? I know that certain ET groups and certain real evil type of demonic forces have the means to trap and ensnare consciousnesses and souls. But what we're talking about is the potential for these dark archontic Sauron type forces to do this on a mass scale. Millions, hundreds of millions, potentially billions. That much being said, many of you had lived and died through the upheavals of the past on this planet. Atlantis, Lemuria, celestially driven cataclysms. And, just a friendly reminder, Planet X, Nibiru, the second sun, call it what you will, it's still there, okay? You don't have to believe me. It doesn't have to be part of your world outlook, your understanding. That's perfectly fine with me. I'm not here to tell anyone what to think. But I do feel that the second sun, Nibiru, call it what you will, is in our solar system, and it's heavily populated. Let's leave it at that. And it's contributing in a big way to these so-called earth changes. So these forces of evil today have the means to do all this and then some. They had the means back then, but they just didn't have that large of a livestock population with which to do all this. Now they do. That much being said, many of you in your past incarnations on this planet have endured horrific things, lived and died. And I mean, you just look at Mount Vesuvius and what happened to Pompeii and what have you. I mean, what a way to go. That was the end of the world for them, that's for sure. Must have seemed that way. And some of you have lived through horrific invasions in past lives, died through horrific invasions. I guess what I'm trying to say is, you're combat veterans, each and every one of you, of the cosmic wars, because not only have you lived and died, sometimes in quite gruesome fashion here on this planet, in previous incarnations, but you've taken part in the Orion Wars and other wars throughout the galaxy, throughout the universe. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it, I'm not going to put too fine of a touch on it, too fine of a gloss on it, and say, oh well, BDDT, you've been there, done that, this is old hat, not your first barbecue. No, no, I would never try to marginalize or minimalize the desperate straits that we're in now, right? I think you can call upon, even if you don't have any conscious memories, your soul retains all of those memories. Your DNA, your morphic resonance field. We're going to incur some casualties. There's going to be, we're in the process of a mass die-off, an extinction level event. And also the potential of what may come after, unless we throw a spanner in the works, unless we find a way to dismantle this control grid, this control system, and send these evil sewer scum packing, not only packing, but ideally wipe them out in the process. Where there's a will, there's a way. And before I end this first segment, I'd like to give a little warning, a public service announcement. I guess this whole talk was something of a warning, but it has come to my attention that there is this so-called grassroots movement in Australia, an anti-New World Order resistance movement, and one of their stated goals is to, using common law, to bring to justice all these perps, and if necessary, the most guilty and those guilty of the most heinous crimes will be executed. Okay? Well, I've checked this group out, and I must say, right off the bat, I cannot take them seriously because their OPSEC is non-existent, operational security. They're going to put up a website, and they're going to encourage people to enlist, essentially, right? To sign up. And I mean, how can I take that seriously? And they're saying sign up at any level, including admin. Oh, we always need admin people, right? What a great place for a spy to infiltrate into, an admin job. Access to all these names and contact information, addresses, etc., etc. And the OPSEC nature, or the lack of the OPSEC, is a red flag for me, because, I mean, could you imagine a member of the French Maquis, the French Resistance in World War II, right, being hunted by the Gestapo, and then he's going to take the time to tack onto a wall in the plaza of his town a message. Oh, we're recruiting for the local French Resistance, the local Maquis. Please meet at Pierre's barn on Saturday night, right? Of course that wouldn't happen. That's absurd to suggest that anyone would conceive of that as being, you know, anything other than ridiculous. But I see no difference in this group who are planning to put a website out encouraging people to join. They're saying that they have all these people already in tow, military, ex-military, law enforcement, etc. They're all ready to make a move. Well, just do it then. Don't tell us about it. And don't go on a recruiting drive. If you've got all these assets, You know, talk's cheap. Actions speak louder than words. Make your move. Bust a move. But don't go on to a recruiting campaign and try to get all these people to join when your OPSEC sucks and is basically non-existent. Oh yeah, I'm a leader of the French Resistance. I'm going to tack on a sign-up sheet in the local town plaza. Sign up to fight the Nazi occupation and to take out the Gestapo. Yeah, meet at Pierre's barn on Saturday night, which is basically what they're doing. So how could I, with somebody that's, I've studied this stuff all my life, I've been a part of the intelligence community, how could I take something like that seriously? I think the problem is, one of the problems is, we have not had yet a well-defined, what I call a Doolittle raid moment. Let me explain what I mean by that. In the early part of the war in the Pacific in World War II, it was nothing from an American and a British and Australian perspective. Well, I'll take that. Let me rephrase that. Mostly from a British and American perspective. It was just unrelieved disaster and failure and catastrophe. One after the other after the other. Just nothing but failure, defeat. Until this, what amounts to a covert operation involving thousands of people, which we now know is the Doolittle raid on Japan. A lot of things had to come into play for that to happen. And I just don't have time to go into it, but it's a fascinating story. But I'll just cut to the chase. The plan was to launch on April 19th, 1942. But the problem was they were sighted by Japanese picket boats. Admiral Yamamoto, in his wisdom, knew that at some point the Americans may try a raid, some kind of a bombing mission, from aircraft carriers. He'd never dreamed that the Americans would launch medium bombers, B-25 Army bombers, from the flight deck of an aircraft carrier. Point of relevance was the task force was sighted, and Admiral Halsey, who commanded the two carrier task force, ordered the American Army bombers to launch. And they were launching well beyond their fuel capacity. The plan was to launch from the carrier Hornet, bomb targets in Japan, including Tokyo, and then fly to China, fly over the coastal areas, which were controlled by the Japanese, and land at pre-prepared airfields. It was not going to happen because of a mix-up and incompetence. There was no airfields ready for them, right? But by being forced to launch early, hundreds of miles early from the carrier, they were almost certain to run out of fuel before they got to China. Now stop and think about that. Now let's backtrack to the beginning of the mission. The USS Hornet was the newest carrier in the United States Navy. It had made the trip from the East Coast and through the Panama Canal and went up to my old stomping grounds, my dad's old stomping grounds, Naval Air Station Alameda, where the USS Hornet parked and took on board 16 B-25 Mitchell bombers. And the commander of that group was Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle, James Doolittle, one of my personal heroes. When I was a boy growing up in the streets of Daly City in San Francisco, every kid my age knew who Jimmy Doolittle was. It didn't matter if they were... I lived in the projects, which was the housing for military dependents, mostly Navy, some Marines, some visiting Air Force, right? I don't recall seeing too many Army brat kids there. But even outside of the projects, the kids we knew from school, the kids we knew, you know, from in Civvy Street, let's say, they knew who Jimmy Doolittle was. Everyone of my age group knew who Jimmy Doolittle was. You could not know. First of all, he was born in Alameda, California, which is in the Bay Area. And then his exploits after that, right? So there was a personal angle for me, because, you know, where the U.S. carrier Hornet docked and took on board the B-25 Mitchells and Doolittle's crews, I'd been to that naval air station. I'd been on board aircraft carriers there as a young boy, the USS Ranger in particular, and the USS Coral Sea. They were both ships that my dad was stationed on. And, you know, the Navy guys were resentful. It's like, oh, what are we, a ferrying service? They're loading all these Army bombers to us. It's like they want us to, I guess, take this somewhere. But what do we look like? You know, a towing service? You know, we're like chauffeurs for the Army now? A lot of the Army people were pissed off, not Army people, I take it back. I mean, the Navy people, because it was all secret, right? So what happened was, he wasn't admiral yet, he was a captain still. The commander of the Hornet, USS Hornet, was captain later, Admiral Mark Mitscher, one of the original naval aviators, and later commanded the legendary Task Force 58, Task Force 38, and went by two different designations at times. These were the fast carrier task forces. But that's, you know, a couple of years, a year and a half, 2 years in the future. Captain Mitscher commanded the Hornet, and he was let in on the secret. They knew where they were going to go. They were going to bomb Tokyo, right? So they used a crane to hoist all those bombers onto the flight deck of the Hornet, and Doolittle had been training his crews incessantly in short takeoffs. They didn't know why they had to, you know, be able to lift off within 400 feet. Now they knew why, because their planes were being loaded onto an aircraft carrier. They had been trained by a Navy guy how to properly rev up their engines and take off with such short space, right? And it wasn't until the task force was underway at sea. It was the USS Hornet. It was just escorting cruisers and destroyers and oilers to refuel the ships in the task force, as well as replenishment ships that, you know, with supplies to replenish the ships underway at sea. It wasn't until they were beyond the Golden Gate Bridge out into the Pacific that Captain Mitscher, over the PA system, the intercom of the aircraft carrier USS Hornet, announced, "This ship will take the Army bombers to the coast of Japan for the bombing of Tokyo." And when he said that, there was first a momentary stunned silence, and then sustained cheering from every part of the ship. And then it all made sense to them. As a matter of fact, the commander of the Marine security contingent on board the Hornet, when he got his first glimpse of Doolittle, he couldn't get this feeling out of his head. I've seen this guy somewhere before, right? And then it dawned on him that this Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle guy is the same Doolittle who had set all these world records in altitude, speed, endurance. He'd invented instrument flight navigation and flight controls. That was a Doolittle invention. He created that. I mean, when I worked at the air base at Naval Air Station North Island, I got to know, you know, some naval aviators, Hornet pilots, and one of the things they always like to talk about was Doolittle, because he trained at Naval Air Station North Island. I think that's where he learned how to fly, right? So, you know, what do these old school naval aviators want to talk about? You know, when I'm sitting there and having a cuppa with them, I want to talk about Doolittle. How he, you know, invented blind instrument flying, which basically means Doolittle with the help of Sperry Rand Corporation, created a flight panel control system, artificial horizon, altitude altimeter, etc., etc. He pulled a canvas awning over the cockpit of his plane, took off blind, flew around for a while, landed it blind. Okay? So now, aviators are no longer relegated to flying only during the day or only during good weather. They can fly anytime. And that was because of Doolittle. Okay? Have you ever been on an airplane, an airliner, and you took off at night, or you flew through fog, or you landed in fog? You can thank the late, great General James Doolittle, a real-life alien hunter, by the way, that was later on in his career. So, getting back to the story, the commander of the USS Hornet announces on the PA to the whole crew of the Hornet, "We're going to bomb Tokyo." Sustained cheering on the whole ship. And then, using the blinker lamps, the semaphore blinking lamps to send Morse messages to the other ships in the task force, they advised the other ships in the task force what they were going to do. They're going to go bomb Tokyo and other cities in Japan. The crewmen on board the Hornet could hear the cheering from the other ships in the task force. Every time that another ship was advised by the semaphore blinker light system of what they were going to do, what their mission was, they could hear all this cheering coming from across the ocean, the body of water that separated the ships. They could hear the cheering from every ship in the task force. Now understand, every single person in that task force knew they were heading deep into Japanese-controlled waters. There was no going back. And then they rendezvoused in the ocean with Admiral Halsey's task force because they needed one carrier to launch the bombers, and they needed another carrier to provide combat air patrol, air cover, fighter cover. So they rendezvous in the middle of the ocean. The people on the Enterprise, Halsey's ship, looking over, "What the heck? It looks like there's a bunch of Army bombers on the Hornet." Didn't compute, because they'd rendezvoused with the Hornet task force. And then Admiral Halsey said over the loudspeaker, "We're going to bomb Tokyo." And again, sustained cheering. See, these people had known, like I said, nothing but defeat for months on end. That's all they've known. Defeat after defeat, humiliation after humiliation. They were aching to strike back any way they could. And understand, they purposely charted a course towards Japan through the worst possible weather to provide them with cover, basically. So when they were found out, and Admiral Halsey had, you know, with his semaphore blinker Morse system, blinked over, with the lights, the message, Army crewmen, man your planes and launch. That was it. They had to go. And in the silly movie Pearl Harbor, it was a chick flick disguised as a war movie, they show the Army bombers led by Doolittle. Just shows you how much Hollywood hates America. Of all the people all the actors they would task with portraying Jimmy Doolittle, they get Alec Baldwin, this obscene, America-hating, just sewer scum, right? They get him playing a foul-mouthed Doolittle, and Doolittle was not a foul-mouthed individual, to play an iconic American hero. That's how much Hollywood hates America. So anyway, in that silly movie, it shows them launching the bombers in clear blue skies, placid seas, nothing of the sort. The bow of the carrier was going up and down with the waves, a difference of 30 feet, from the trough to the height of the wave. They had to launch each plane just as the bow of the carrier was being pushed upwards by the waves, because if the plane took off at the edge of the carrier while the bow of the ship was plummeting downwards in the trough of the wave, the plane would have went straight into the ocean, right? Get this. Doolittle said to the crews after Admiral Halsey ordered the planes to launch, because Admiral Halsey's responsibility was the protection and the safety of the two carriers. The Americans were running out of carriers in the Pacific. They only had like three or four, including the New Hornet at that time. They could not lose anymore. The Japanese outnumbered them in carriers 2 or 3 to 1, right? So Halsey, understandably, wanted to get his carriers out of hostile waters, hence his order to launch Doolittle's planes hours ahead of schedule. And Doolittle said to his assembled crews, okay, we've been ordered to launch. This offer still stands. Any of you could back out right now. Nothing more will be said. We have replacement crews that could take over your ship if you don't want to go. Nobody said anything. Doolittle got into the lead plane, and in so many words, when Doolittle asked that, do you want to back out? Any of you back out? Because by then it had dawned on everyone that it was essentially a suicide mission. They were not going to have enough fuel to make it to mainland China. Right? Now stop and think about this. All those Americans out there, and all those Brits, and all those Aussies, and all those military big shot tough guys, right? And you haven't really fought for your countries yet. Fighting against the Taliban, and they gave Afghanistan back to the Taliban, does not constitute fighting for your country. I don't care what you think. I don't care how much you relive your glories in your podcasts, because I've listened to them. And none of you, hardly any of you, have any self-reflection of how you've been used and how you've been played. So don't come around trying to big shot me with how you fought for your country. The biggest fight is yet ahead. It's the biggest fight is now. Right? And when Doolittle said, anyone want to back out? Okay, no one's going to back out. Fine. Doolittle turned. He got on his plane. In other words, Doolittle was saying, I'm going with you or without you. I'm going to fly my ship, my B-25 Mitchell. I'm not going to even turn back. You can go with me or you don't go with me. I don't care. I'm Jimmy Doolittle, right? And of course, when Doolittle was able to get that plane off the flight deck for less than 400 feet, okay, the other guys followed. The other crews followed. They bombed their targets in Japan, turned towards China. Providentially, fortune favors the brave. Fortune favors the brave. They had a powerful tailwind that pushed most of the planes to mainland China, not far enough to get beyond the coastal areas controlled by the Japanese. Right? Some of the planes had a ditch in the ocean near the shore. Others, the crews had a bailout, and some crash landed with the crews on board. On Doolittle's plane, once they got over the Chinese mainland, he ordered his crew to bail out while he held the plane in steady flight. He bailed out after everyone else did, and he landed literally in a shit field. Because in China, at nighttime, they have what they call night soil, where the farmers bring out buckets of human excrement, and they use that as fertilizer. So they scoop up all this crap from the latrines, and then they at nighttime, at dusk, they bring it out to the fields, and they use it to fertilize their crops. And here comes Doolittle bailing out of his plane in a parachute, literally lands in a shit field. And there's a picture of him, sitting down near the wreck of his plane, and he's just looking totally disconsolate. He's thinking, I don't know where the rest of my crews are. I don't know where I am. I'm going to be court-martialed. I'm going to be arrested. If I make it out of here, I'm going to be arrested. Because this mission was a total flop. Well, it wasn't a total flop. It was a pinprick as far as, you know, especially the later air raids were concerned. The mega bombing missions and firebomb missions under LeMay later on. But that was fast-forwarding a couple of years, 2-3 years in the future. But although it was a pinprick, the effect it had on the American populace to be able to finally strike back, to do something, and also the chain of events that it triggered. Admiral Yamamoto got what he wanted. He'd been pressing for some time to conduct operations in the Coral Sea and Midway, and both turned out to be, especially Midway, turned out to be a resounding defeat for the Japanese. All that was set in motion by Doolittle's raid. Doolittle was promoted, you know, 2 grades to Brigadier General and given the Medal of Honor. Later on, he commanded Army Air Forces in Northwest Africa, and later he commanded the Mighty 8th and 8th Air Force in England. But the point of relevance is, you see, we haven't seen a Doolittle raid yet. We haven't seen something happen of a definitive nature when we can say, yep, that's the good guys doing this, right? This is why these stories of the white hats gain so much currency, gain so much momentum, and now you have this group in Australia where they're going to be advertising on a website for people to join up so they can, you know, eventually arrest and execute all the bad guys that are running Australia. That's just ridiculous. But the only reason something like that gains any kind of currency at all is because, you know, people want to do something. They want to strike back, is what they want. They want to hit back in some way, the same way Doolittle did. And we haven't had that. We haven't had a Doolittle raid, a Doolittle mission yet. And I don't know if we will. You know why? Because a lot of these active military people and retired military people, they got, if they're officers, oh, they got pensions, they got families, you know, they got a lot to lose. Yeah, I talked about the Battle of Hue earlier. Those were 17, 18-year-old Marines. They had a lot to lose, too. A lot of them never had adulthood lives like we did. Sorry for the bad English. Right? I mean, look at the Doolittle Raiders. They knew they were not going to have enough fuel even to make it to the Chinese mainland. They went anyway. Because what they were doing was more important than themselves. And those guys had families, too. Back home in America. Had loved ones. They were on a classified mission. So, you know, while you military types and ex-military types that are reliving your glories in your podcast... And another thing, and I'll leave it at this too, is just sick of the fanboy mentality. You know, when I go into these military-oriented Facebook groups or listen to these podcasts on YouTube, it's, you read the comments, and most of them are a bunch of fanboys. And you point out this, you know, they seem to think that these military people that they worship and idolize are infallible, they never make mistakes. And when you point out that, yeah, such and such commander made a lot of mistakes in this campaign or that campaign, they just get all bent out of shape. Like it's just upsetting to them so much to think that these guys are not infallible, that they make mistakes, and some of them were downright lousy commanders that got their troops killed for nothing, except, you know, in their quest for glory and fame, which is not a good enough reason, you know, to throw men's lives away in combat. There has to be a bigger purpose behind that. But you can't tell that to these fanboys, right? And like, these fanboys don't know what we know, either. They don't know about what's going on in the world. They just, like, idolize and worship the military. And they don't realize how controlled it is. You know, it's run by a Secretary of Defense that hates America. It's run by this digital... virtual president who hates America and that's who the commander-in-chief is, right? And they're still hoping Trump will come back and somehow save all this. It's just, the whole thing is ridiculous. So I'm calling out all you military types out there, right? If you're not going to do something, just shut the F up. I don't mind you talking about some of your experiences in your podcast. I'm a believer in freedom of speech. I'll fight. I'll fight for freedom of speech till whenever. A million lifetimes down the track, I'll fight for the freedom of speech. I'll fight for freedom in general, right? And I know some of you have to walk on eggshells. You don't want to be, you know, banned from YouTube for talking about certain things. But at least speak in a way. Be as elliptical as you want. But kind of let it be known to those watching that you have an idea what's going on. Right? That you're not just reliving past glories. Right? So that's why these fake movements, which are... This movement in Australia, if you ask me, it just a means to get gullible, hopeful people who want to strike back to recruit them, so they wind up, you know, being tossed into the camps one day, right? So just keep that point in mind. That there's this group out there, you know, they're recruiting all these people in Australia, or trying to, and their OPSEC is non-existent. In fact, it's a joke. So, you know, we haven't had that Doolittle raid moment yet. I'm not holding my breath for it. But you never know. Right? I mean, you never know how this thing will play out. It's not written in stone. So anyhow, I just wanted to get, you know, these thoughts out there as far as the siege is concerned, as far as the Doolittle raid moment is concerned, and what the Doolittle raid meant for Americans and you know, free people everywhere back then. Anyhow, thank you for listening, and for our dear members out there, we've got something for you. We'll be coming up with a part two before too long, and for those of you listening now, wherever you may be, whatever you may be doing, have a very pleasant time. We'll see you next time. Bye for now. Because this is a frequency war.